Hello. On this week's program, as the Philadelphia Orchestra prepares to release its latest CD, we speak with music director Christoph Eschenbach. Susan Lewis looks ahead to Japanese Masters of the Brush, the latest exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And Jason Pfeiffer examines the role of the dramaturg in theatre. We'll hear from several local practitioners about their behind-the-scenes work. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
This week, the Philadelphia Orchestra releases its fifth recording on the Ondine label. The All Tchaikovsky CD features his fourth symphony along with the second half of The Seasons with music director Christoph Eschenbach on piano. The first half of The Seasons was on the orchestra's previously released recording of Tchaikovsky's fifth symphony. Earlier this week, I spoke with Christoph Eschenbach and first asked him if there was a dedicated pattern to how these CDs were being released.
They are being released as they are ready and as they are finished in the after production. And while this Tchaikovsky 4, in a way, falls into a pattern like Tchaikovsky 5, where we added, or I added, or the record company added with
me. Well, you
me.
Had to play
the Seasons of Tchaikovsky, the 12, and on the record with Tchaikovsky 5, we have the first 6, chronological, and now with number 4, we have the rest, the other 6, also chronological, July until December. Mm-hmm. And with Tchaikovsky 6, which will... maybe it's premature to say that, but which will be released, I think, sometime at the end of the year. There is also a piano piece, Dumka, on it.
You often joke about the fact that when you now play solo piano, that it's kind of something that is not so important. You tend to be very self-deprecating about it. Is it a different part of your musical brain to go from being the conductor to, you know, being in control of 100-plus musicians, to actually just being a direct relationship between you and your instrument?
Well, I like playing, and therefore I keep it up, so to say. It's sometimes very difficult because I have lots of programs to do with this orchestra, with my other orchestra in Paris, with the guest conducting around the world. But last year, being the Mozart year, I was asked by several institutions, including ours, to play some Mozart concerti again in conduct from the keyboard. And I had so much fun with it. Of course, I had to practice a bit more than usual, plus the fact that I recorded solo piano, which I hadn't done in many, many, many years, gave me much of the pleasure back of piano playing, where in recent years I had the feeling, well, I play it because I like to play with my musician friends in the orchestra, the chamber music, and here and there a song recital. But now I won't begin to be a recitalist again.
Well, that wouldn't be a bad thing.
By no means. But I have a new pleasure with the piano, and I'm quite happy with that.
Thank you.
July Reaper Song from Tchaikovsky's The Seasons, Christoph Eschenbach Piano from the Philadelphia Orchestra's latest release on the Ondine label, which also features Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. Let's now return to our conversation with Christoph Eschenbach. Because there was a period when you didn't do recitals or you didn't solo.
Well, I've never done recitals since 78.
All right, so it was a good long time. Yeah. Did something happen in your head or in your hands in that period? Did the evolution of your playing continue despite the fact that you weren't regularly performing live?
Strangely enough, it did. Probably by listening to so many people and to listening live to so many people, pianists whom I played with as conductor, whom I accompanied with orchestra. And also very much, I must say, very much through the experience of working with singers. So my ambition was always to not play the piano, to instead instrumentate on the piano, to play oboe on the piano, or to play cello on the piano. But more and more, it is to sing on the piano. And that is the advantage of having worked with many great singers and still working with wonderful singers. I just came from Paris and we had a wonderful, wonderful 2 weeks of a concert performance of Thaïs by Massenet, Miss René mm-hmm. Fleming and Gerald Finley, which was absolutely, again, enormous pleasure and also learning process about what is it about voice. And I mean, if you have singers like that, then you can be extremely happy in your musical, in the music making totally.
Can I ask you, can you sing?
No. No, of course I can sing. Everybody can sing a little bit. But I don't really want to recommend that to be heard by other people.
So only in the shower, not for a paying public.
Yes, it's a very close shower, yes.
Thank you.
an excerpt from the final movement of Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, the Philadelphia Orchestra conducted by its music director Christoph Eschenbach. That's from the orchestra's latest CD on the Ondine label, which is released on Tuesday. It also features the concluding 6 months of Tchaikovsky's The Seasons with Maestro Eschenbach on piano.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
From the beginning, the Philadelphia Museum of Art has collected Asian art. The city, and the museum in particular, has maintained a relationship with Japan, evident in the reconstructed Japanese tea room in the museum's permanent collection, Shofuso, the Japanese house in West Fairmount Park, and the cherry blossoms that accent the cityscape, particularly at this time of year. This week, in cooperation with the National Museum in Tokyo and the Osaka Municipal Museum, the Philadelphia Museum of Art opens a new exhibition of Japanese art that would be difficult to replicate, even in Japan. Drawing from private and museum collections from Japan and elsewhere, it gathers in one place many rarely seen works of two great 18th century Japanese artists. WRTI's Susan Lewis has more.
Philadelphia has connections with Japan that go back even before the art museum was founded. Museum director Anne Darnincourt says the relationship started with America's Centennial Exhibition in 1876.
In Philadelphia, for the first time in the United States, were gathered works of art from Asia and many things from Japan. People saw what a great opportunity it was to have a great international exhibition and project in the city, and they said, oh, well, in that case, we have to have an art museum.
In this new exhibition, the museum shows these works in a way that gives the visitor a taste of the holistic experience of viewing Japanese art, starting with a walk down a long hallway, its plum-colored walls accented by gray-tone vertical columns, but without other ornamentation or artwork. Museum curator of Japanese art, Felice Fisher, says that in Japanese culture, art is an activity in which the viewer participates.
Everything has to be unrolled, unfurled, unfolded to view. It's the anticipation and preparing yourself spiritually for what you're going to see. So it's not just something there to be viewed from a distance in awe in a frame on the wall.
Of course, in a museum, art hangs on the walls. But in these galleries, the jade-toned walls, the low lighting, and the delicate nature of much of the work creates a quiet, almost reverential ambiance. And to really see the art, you have to get up close. This intimacy gives you an opportunity to get to know Ike Taiga. Described by Nobuyuki Minato, executive vice director of the Tokyo National Museum, as one of Japan's most influential masters.
Taiga is one of the most important Japanese artists, especially. He's the most famous literati painter, and his wife named Gyokuran is also a well-known female artist in the 18th century. Basically, a literati painter is not painting for the sake of making money, but for the sake of one's own pleasure.
Although painting in the literati style, Taiga did sell his work. Born in 1723 into a socially humble family, he showed signs of virtuosity at an early age. Curator Felice Fisher says it was his talent for calligraphy that first caught the attention of the learned class.
And he was fortunate in that when he was about 6 or 7, his very smart mother took him to a temple near Kyoto where there were Chinese monks and calligraphers, and he did a calligraphy demonstration for them. And they said, this child is a prodigy, he's brilliant.
With the monks, Taiga studied calligraphy. From there, Japanese painting was a short brushstroke away, and by his early teens, Taiga became a working artist. At 14, he opened a fan shop to help support himself and his widowed mother. There, he came to the attention of wealthy patrons. By his mid-20s, he was a celebrity painter, known as a bit of an eccentric. He married Tokiyama Gyokuran, who was a successful poet and painter. By all accounts, they created an extraordinary, if unorthodox, partnership, studying and working together, painting, doing calligraphy, and writing poetry. The show reveals the intimacy of these three arts. Poetry, calligraphy, and painting were skills an enlightened person aspired to perfect. They were known in Chinese and Japanese literati culture as the three perfections. Calligraphy, in its expression of poetry, embodies both language and art and takes on even greater significance, says Felice Fisher.
It's believed that calligraphy, because it's sort of a direct extension of the hand, is an expression of the artist's inner being as well, and that if you're a good calligrapher, you're also a good person, even not only aesthetically, but even morally.
In this exhibition, poetry is translated into English. Hiroyuki Shimatani, director of cultural properties at the Tokyo National Museum, who also co-authored the essay on calligraphy in the book that accompanies the show, says calligraphy can be appreciated also for its own imagery.
Of course, the best way is to appreciate the form as well as the meanings. It might be difficult, not only for Americans, but also for Japanese these days. But the images we can appreciate for their beauty. The audience can trace the artist's psychological feelings or thoughts and track such kind of feelings.
This exhibition is not only the first major U.S. show of Taiga's work, it's the first show anywhere in the world of the work of Gyokuran, who was equally successful in her lifetime, but who is less well known today. Ann Darnincourt says the exhibition is also noteworthy for the works it reunites.
Reunions between works of art by Gyokuran and Taiga, reunions of the suites of work by Taiga, which have not been together maybe even since they left the artist's studio.
The 209 pieces in the show include paintings and calligraphy on large screens, hanging scrolls, album and fan paintings, including 12 works designated for special protection by the Japanese government. Hiroyuki Shimatani says this gathering of works would be unusual even in Japan.
It's very difficult to organize this kind of exhibition, to collect many artworks. It probably can't be done in Japan, but because of the reputation of the Philadelphia Museum, they could borrow these.
Although Taiga is best known as one of the leaders of the Nanga, or Southern painting movement that emulated a Chinese form of landscape painting, he tried many styles and subjects. The philosophical freedom to buck convention may have started with finger painting, or rather, fingernail painting, as Felice Fisher describes.
It's a very difficult technique because you have to let your fingernail grow and you have to actually move the paper surface around because you don't have the flexibility that you do with a brush. It gave him a chance using a different tool to free himself from the dictates and preconceived ideas of brushwork. But once he sort of felt that he was free to do what he wanted to do, he translated some of those techniques back into brush painting.
The show illustrates the variety in their output. Many works are representations of the familiar subjects of bamboo, orchid, plum, and chrysanthemum. Large landscapes are painted in different styles, some with Chinese subjects and some true view works, which Taiga painted from memory after his travels. And there is also humor. Depictions of goblins, festivals, and humorous figures like the man eating too many sweet potatoes, and the screens that illustrate a song of the great eight drinkers. But a listing of subjects and styles can't really convey the experience of this exhibition. There are beautiful pictures, but there is a sense of entering another zone, another time and place, where the world is seen just a bit differently, where beauty can be uncovered in a majestic mountain, a delicate petal, or the single sweep of a brush dipped in black ink. Ike Taiga and Tokiyama Gyokuran, Japanese Masters of the Brush, runs through July 22nd at the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Look over a list of job titles in theater, and mostly you won't have difficulty working out what people do. Actors act, directors direct, set designers design sets, stage managers manage a stage, etc. But scroll down the list of theatre professionals to dramaturg, and unless you're in the know or in the business, you could well be scratching your head. So now, as part of his continuing series on what it takes to bring theatre to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer sets about exploring the role or even multiple roles of the dramaturg.
Not every theatre company or theatre production has an official dramaturg, but the work of a dramaturg is used in nearly every show. Even so, it's one of the least understood positions in theater. Wilma Theater dramaturg Walter Bilderback says the exact function of the role is tough to pin down.
It's a profession where I think everyone who does it would probably have their own definition that sort of coincides either with what it is they do or what it is they'd like to be doing. I've been doing it for a long time, and the job has varied slightly with each theater and with each director I've worked with.
Dramaturgy traces back to 18th century German writer and philosopher Gotthold Lessing. He wrote a collection of theoretical and critical essays about theater, which came to be known as the Hamburg Dramaturgy. Since the time of Lessing, different forms of dramaturgy have been practiced in Europe, but it wasn't until the 1960s that the role started to emerge in the United States, when the not-for-profit regional theater system took off. One way to look at the modern dramaturg is as a facilitator. They support the work of others, such as the director, the designer, or the playwright. This work can look different from theater to theater. For instance, in a company that does mostly established works, a dramaturg does a lot of research. He or she is the resident historian, investigating the political, philosophical, and cultural context of a play and its playwright, explaining the meanings of phrases and references in a script. Basically, making sure that everyone involved knows what the play is about in depth.
I've seen this tracking shot. I mean, he's taking in this whole world. I mean, the way right. The mise-en-scène that he's created. And
Philadelphia Theater Company dramaturg Warren Hoffman often spends time with actors and directors during the first days of rehearsals to go over this type of material, to answer questions, and alongside the director to observe the process. Hoffman says that most good directors are and should be dramaturgs, too.
Anytime you're working on a script and trying to answer questions about it, make it better, you're doing dramaturgy. But most regional theaters have someone who's dedicated to this role.
And by most regional theaters, Hoffman means the nonprofit theaters outside of the Broadway, New York commercial theater circuit. In the larger companies, with a full season of demanding works and many responsibilities, a lot of directors and artistic directors don't have the time to dedicate to extensive dramaturgical work. Especially in a theater that produces a lot of new plays, a dramaturg commonly wears the hat of literary manager. This might involve helping to choose the season lineup, selecting the best translation, writing program notes, and leading after-show discussions. But it always means a lot of reading, according to Warren Hoffman.
Like many regional companies, we get approximately 300 plays sent to us over the course of a year, mainly from agents, sometimes submitted by local playwrights. And it's my job, in addition to our producing artistic director, to interns, to read through those scripts and to decide what we want to produce. Only about 10% of those plays do we even have an interest in, and if we're lucky, maybe 1% of what's actually submitted to us will actually get produced.
If a playwright is around, Hoffman says dramaturgs like himself can work with the author to help bring more clarity to a script, asking questions, offering suggestions, advice, and support. If the playwright is not around, dramaturgs are often described as advocates for the playwright and their intentions for the play. But while an advocate for or defender of the text is a common metaphor used to describe dramaturgy, University of Pennsylvania theater professor and dramaturg Carrie Mazur thinks that the explanation is misleading.
What the dramaturg is, if the dramaturg is an advocate of anything, is a defender of the work of art that's being made. If you're working with a playwright, then you're helping the playwright tell the story the playwright wants to tell and trying to stay true to that playwright's vision and aesthetics. If you're working with a director with a pre-existing dramatic text, the last thing that you have a loyalty to is to the script and the playwright. Your job is not to defend what that play has become in the past, but what this bunch of artists want to do with it right now.
Mazur explains that helping a theater group tell the best story possible often means provoking dialogue. Though never adversarial, it means asking a lot of tough, pesky questions. This role earns dramaturgs the label of in-house critic. But while a dramaturg might have input into many different aspects of a theater, Michelle Volansky, Washington College theater professor and former president of the Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas, says a dramaturg can't claim ownership of much. One reason many find they're not cut out for the role.
In order to do this job, you have to remember a sense of humility. And you don't get to make the final decision about anything. You can agitate, you can advocate, you can do a lot of dances to try and get a play produced. But at the end of the day, the artistic director picks the plays, the director is directing the plays, the playwright is writing the play. And so the task of being another set of eyes in the room is a lot of people just can't handle it. There's an ego or two involved in theater. I'm not sure if you're aware of this. And sometimes they get huge. And if it becomes about the dramaturg, then something is very, very flawed.
Indeed, while dramaturgs provide vital resources for theater pieces, the Wilma Theater's Walter Bilderbach says that accolades for dramaturgy are usually not a good thing.
A sign of success for me is really usually that the work is relatively invisible to an audience, that the director's work is better but looks like the director, that the playwright's work is better but looks like the playwright, that the actors, etc., etc.
With over 25 years of experience as a dramaturg, Bilderbach says the profession has greatly expanded over the time of his career. He notes he doesn't need to explain his job to people as much as he did a few decades ago. Yet while most theaters don't need convincing that dramaturgs have great value, many companies still view a full-time dramaturg as a luxury. Michelle Volansky says that with a very limited number of dramaturg jobs out there to begin with, work can become scarce, coinciding with a theater's financial well-being and the economy at large.
The economy goes up and down, and when the economy goes down, dramaturgs lose jobs. When the economy goes up, there's a lot of jobs.
Perhaps it'd be worth adding defender of theater funding to the job description of a dramaturg. But then again, considering the wide scope of responsibilities they have, dramaturgs probably have enough on their plate already.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Megan Wendell, Jill Franks, Catherine Blodgett, and Norman Keyes. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.